Hello and welcome to Radio Verulam, where once again we're speaking to local MP Daisy Cooper to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get your answers from Daisy this time, she'll be back again next month in March 2021. But we usually start with me asking how you are, Daisy. And I will ask that as well, of course. You know, we're all interested in that you're doing well. But I also do want to bring up the fact that your cat has been a little bit poorly. And you told people on social media handles that your feline friend had a bit of a scrap. So how are they doing as well?
Yeah, it's my little boy cat, Benji. He's clearly been in a bit of a scrap. And it looks like, or did look last week, like another cat, possibly a dog, maybe a fox, we don't know, had bitten his paw. And so he had teeth marks on top of his paw, but also underneath in the padded area. So he's been limping around. And then we got him some antibiotics and some painkillers, which he then vomited up all over the house. So he's been a bit sorry for himself and a bit poorly and a bit sore. But the animalism vets, have done a really, really good job looking after him. And so he's on the mend.
Oh, well, that's great news. And there's also been some other brilliant news for your family, because I always include pets as family. And your mother actually had her first COVID jab. You said on social media you had a little cry because it is emotional. You know, I had my gran have her first jab this month, and her and I were both very emotional because she's basically been trapped for almost a year, not being able to go out. And obviously she's not going crazy and partying or anything, but she does feel a bit more security. So how is your mother doing after her first vaccine? Did she have any adverse effects, or was she all fine?
She's been absolutely fine. She's had a little bit of a sore arm where the jab actually went in, but that's not unusual. But she's had no other side effects. And one thing that I thought was quite funny was that my mum went to get her vaccine. She got an NHS volunteer to take her. And because she doesn't, you know, live in St Albans, and she didn't think anything of it. But obviously afterwards, I sort of gave her a ring and I was very tearful, and she was quite surprised about it. She didn't realise that it would be such a sense of relief to me. When I posted that on social media, what was clear was that there are so many of us, aren't there? There's so many of us who are hugely relieved for our loved ones, particularly older members of our family and those who may be clinically vulnerable, who have been, you know, sort of living in fear for months and months and months, you know, at home, keeping their distance, being sort of rightly incredibly cautious about the sort of precautions that they're taking. And so it's just been wonderful to see so many people. And I've been talking to the GPs at our local Batchford Vaccination Centre, and they've been quite emotional as well, because they've had so many people who have been coming in for their jabs getting a bit teary. So it's just a really lovely thing. And it's just a wonderful sign of sort of hope of light at the end of the tunnel. And of course, you know, these vaccines, we don't have all the evidence yet as to how they're going to work and whether they're going to give us full protection and whether people can still transmit the virus. All that evidence is going to come through. But I think that, you know, it's just really, really lovely, isn't it, to see people getting their vaccinations started.
It's great to hear. And also the news with vaccines as well there. You said your mother had a sore arm. The doctors always say it's a good sign if you have a bit of a reaction, because that means it's working. That means that your body's fighting the virus. But brilliant news, and a great way to start the chats today before we move into some more serious topics. But one before we get onto the serious topic is that positive story that you talked about there, the Batchford COVID Vaccination Centre. It was stated by Health Secretary himself, Matt Hancock. It is one of the best, highest performing vaccination teams in the country. Daisy, how has this achievement been brought about?
Well, it's absolutely brilliant. And it's been a partnership between the local GPs and the local council. So as soon as the Batchford Hall became available, the council knew about that because they own the building. And what's really interesting is when the government first designed its rollout plan for vaccines, it didn't even think to include local GPs. So actually it was all going to be done in a centralized way, you know, using people who are in other parts of the NHS. But right across the country, GPs have stepped up into action, and they've set up these centers on their own. They've been really, really quick to react. Here in St Albans, it's GPs from I think about 12 different practices in St Albans and Harpenden. So all credit to the GPs, who themselves have got themselves organized, they've got them set up. They sorted out contacting the NHS, getting the vaccines, working closely with the St Albans District Council. They've just done an absolutely sterling job. So, you know, a huge congratulations to Dr. Mike Walton, Helen McAndrew, Zoe Matthews, all the team and volunteers as well. It's been a real community effort. And I think it's a real testament to what can be done when you trust local people to run a local solution to a major problem. I think it's been a really brilliant community effort, and it's huge congratulations from me to everybody involved.
It's good to hear, and hopefully this positiveness continues because it seems to be having a bit of an effect on the COVID numbers as well. But we do have to turn our attention to something that has affected our local area as well. And you've been campaigning for the removal of all unsafe cladding at no cost to the consumers. The government has promised $3.5 billion towards this, but have set a height limit, and thus people who do not meet the specifications will have to get loans to pay off what is unsafe cladding. Do you see this as a first step in the right direction, or are you worried that the government will now see this as the matter over with and land people with unfair loans?
This problem is not going away. I think it's important to state for people who aren't familiar with the issue that this is to do with the Grenfell fire that we saw in London. We're now 3.5 years on from that, and there's still thousands of flats around the country, including many in St Albans, where there's unsafe cladding. Some of that cladding, it's not the same cladding that they had on the Grenfell Tower, but there's other types of Grenfell cladding that could be that are still very dangerous. But there's lots of other fire safety remediation work that needs to happen. So there are problems with the materials in the floors between flats, and sometimes in the walls, and some of them don't have water sprinklers and things like that. There's all sorts of, you know, balconies that aren't fit for purpose. There's all sorts of additional issues on top of the cladding. And the government seems to have set this sort of arbitrary figure of the 18 metres, saying that, you know, above 18 metres, those buildings are obviously more dangerous. So the government's going to provide some funding towards sorting out problems in those blocks of flats, but it isn't going to provide any funding for those that are under 18 metres. Now, in St Albans, we have both types. We have some buildings that are over 18 metres and some that are under 18 metres. And for those that are under 18 metres, this is a huge worry because some of them are only just starting their process of getting the fire safety certificates. There's been a huge backlog, so they're only starting to realise they've even got materials on their building. So it was too late for them to even apply for a government fund, and I'm going to be pushing the government to reopen that fund. But you're right, some of these leaseholders are going to face a situation where there's going to be, you know, huge debts put on a particular building. So the debt will be attached to a building, but of course that translates through to the costs that each leaseholder is going to have to pay for. And if anybody's trying to sell their flat or to move on, or they want to downsize or something like that, that's going to be incredibly difficult. So I'm pleased that the government has given some additional funding to those who are in buildings that are above 18 metres, but there's still no solution for those that are under 18 metres, and still no solution for both types of buildings for all the other fire safety remediation problems that they're facing. So this issue isn't going away anytime soon.
Moving on to another issue, especially made apparent by COVID-19 and the lockdowns. Mind, the mental health charity, has said that the mental health crisis services are under-resourced, understaffed and overstretched. This month you talked to the Ollie Foundation and also promoted Gretzi Richardson's book, One for Sorrow, with its happy ending, as you said yourself. What is being done for better mental health provisions across the country, especially with COVID-19 increasing suffering for so many people nationwide?
Well, the first thing to say is that we are very fortunate in St Albans that we've got a lot of really good mental health charities. There's It's Okay to Say, there's the Ollie Foundation, which you're right, I met with recently, and there's Youth Talk as well. And a number of our schools are really good at providing sort of mental health training and a sort of a point person for students to go to if they're concerned. But the honest answer is that there just isn't enough. And this is a national challenge that we're facing. And I really hope that the government puts the mental health and well-being of the nation front and centre, particularly when it comes to the budget next month. We do need to see a lot more, especially as well for our NHS frontline workers and care workers, because they will have seen so much death and so much panic and so much illness over the last year. They'll be suffering from really severe trauma, as will lots of people who, you know, will have who are families who are bereaved, who won't have been able to say goodbye in the way that they wanted to. So I think collectively as a nation, we are going to be seeing a tsunami of mental ill health over the next few months and possibly next couple of years. And therefore, we do need to see the government doing a lot more.
And with this campaigning that you're doing, has the government actually said to you that they agree that they will be moving towards giving some more funding or some sort of care? Or is this kind of silence at the moment with agreement with what you're talking about?
I think everybody recognises that there is a mental health challenge. I think the question is recognising the scale of it, and that's the issue. So the government has recognised that there are mental ill health challenges in the country, but we do want to see them doing more, because the level of ambition at the moment is not high enough. So we'll continue to bang that drum.
Moving on to a different issue, which is about how history is being taught or discussed in the country. And I wanted to ask your feelings on the government's new guidelines on the teaching of history, rooting out those who have been called doing Britain down, and the apparent warning of fines or defunding if you don't comply with government-approved histories. Is this right?
Well, I find it very worrying. And I think this is becoming a very divisive subject, and I think it's becoming divisive unnecessarily. What I'm really worried about is that, you know, we as a country have a very mixed history. There are things of, you know, things in Britain's past of which we can be incredibly proud, but there are things, of course, which are deeply troubling as well. And the fact is, whilst the past is fixed, history is always being reinvented as things, you know, as new discoveries are made, and history is always being rewritten. You know, it's not a static thing. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement in particular has been a real impetus for people calling for Black history to be taught, not just in our schools, but in our cultural institutions and in National Trust buildings as well, wherever we might go, and to have the full history of our country taught. And I worry that at the moment it's only one version. And I think it's a very dangerous road to go down, where people say that anybody who's doing Britain down might get fined or defunded, because rather than embracing freedom of speech and encouraging a more rounded version of our history to be taught and learned, what I think this is borders on is a very dangerous authoritarian route that is actually those in power deciding what version of history can or can't be taught. And I think that's very, very dangerous, and it goes completely against our British values in terms of our beliefs in free speech.
Yes, it does seem there's a bit of irony, because it has been dubbed for protecting open discussion. So would you dub this as an attack on free speech?
Yes, I would. And I think it's really important for all of us to remember what free speech really means. You know, free speech has always been the idea that every single individual, every, you know, ordinary member of the public, you know, ordinary folk, that we can speak truth to power. Free speech is not about those who are in power deciding what truth is and what can be spoken about and what can't. That isn't what free speech is. So I'm really worried that this is an abuse of power. It's not about giving people the right to free speech.
Linked to this, and again, this has been dubbed, as you've said there, an abuse of people's freedom. But this month, I think it was actually this week, Priti Patel came out and said that the Black Lives Matter protests were dreadful and that she wouldn't take the knee, and was very critical of all that. So I have to ask you, what type of protest does the government approve of and think is acceptable in 2021?
Well, I mean, I was really disappointed and appalled, actually, that the Home Secretary singled out the Black Lives Matter protests as ones that she deemed to be dreadful, as opposed to any other protests where dreadful things had actually happened. Now, you know, we know that whenever there's any kind of movement, there can be you know, there's often fringe elements on any protest for anything at all that want to cause trouble. But last year, we saw protests right across the country in support of the Black Lives Matter movement, here, you know, including here in St Albans. They were peaceful. They were socially distant. There were hugely inspiring speeches where people talked about their own experiences of racism here in St Albans and beyond. There were allies who were there, like me, talking about what we're trying to do, and also you know, trying to admit that you know we still have a long way to go in learning at what to do. And I was really troubled that the Home Secretary singled out the Black Lives Matter movement, as opposed to, for example, the far-right protests that we saw in London last year, where one protester was actually photographed urinating on the plaque that had been dedicated to a police constable, Keith Palmer, who had actually been murdered during the stabbing in Westminster in a terrorist attack. And so if you're going to single out anybody at all for not having peaceful protests, I would have hoped that she would have singled out that one instead. So I'm very worried that there is this agenda that the government is subscribing to, which is a kind of divide and conquer. We don't want to live in a divided country. I don't want to live in a divided country. And this kind of language where she's stigmatizing particular groups as opposed to others, I think is underhand and very dangerous. I don't stand for it. I was very proud to attend and speak at the Black Lives Matter protest in St Albans, and I will continue to support that movement. I'll continue to support all and every action that is legal and peaceful to get equality for all.
So let's move the discussions onto what the local community wants to know. As always, with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here to help the community. And we called for questions for you, Daisy. So let's move on to that. And just a reminder to people, you can always email me, jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com, for these discussions every month. So the first question is Gina. And Gina has said, you are pressuring the government to bring about visa-free arrangements for touring musicians. She actually mentioned some of the great groups and touring spots that we do have in St Albans, like Enter Shikari. She said, has any progress been made on this?
Not yet. And it's really disappointing. I mean, she's absolutely right to mention Enter Shikari. We've got loads of great talent coming out of St Albans, bands, and we've got lots of musicians and freelance musicians you know, who travel widely across Europe as part of their work. So we've got some great bands here in St Albans and lots of individuals who are self-employed musicians. And even though they work for British orchestras or they're part of British bands, they get a lot of their work from touring around the EU. And at the moment, they're not going to be able to do that. They're obviously, once we're through the coronavirus restrictions and they can travel again, they're just going to really struggle because there's a huge amount of paperwork that's going to be required, not just completing visas, but also all sorts of customs forms for their equipment and any trucks that are required and all sorts of stuff. So I've challenged the government on this in Westminster. Liberal Democrats as a whole, as a party, we organised a letter that was signed by hundreds of really famous musicians demanding that the government sort this issue out because it's really important. And what we've heard in the last couple of days is that even really big established organisations like the National Theatre are saying that even they are not making any plans to do any EU touring next year because the paperwork is just too burdensome. So it's going to really damage our creative industries and damage the prospects for lots of musicians and artists in St Albans and around the country.
Do you believe that the government's resources are stretched because of COVID at the moment, or do they have the ability to sort out this visa-free arrangement for musicians, especially with relaxation probably coming up on the horizon?
Well, it's really not clear. I mean, the EU had said that the UK had opted out of this, and the UK government's claiming that the EU hadn't offered it. So it seems to be a sort of pointing fingers kind of thing. But the fact is, it needs to be sorted. And it is really important because our creative industries as a whole are worth £100 billion to the economy. They're the fastest growing sector of our entire economy. And if we want our economy to grow as we come out of the pandemic, we're going to need to invest in our creative industries. And if musicians and performers and artists can't tour around the EU, then we're losing some of our biggest markets.
Now, moving on to, I think this has been really discussed about in the ether at the moment, but vaccine scams. And Michael has actually asked, how do you spot a vaccine scam or not? And where can I report them?
Okay, so there's a number of different kinds of scams at the moment. Any scam that, or any email or phone call you get that asks you to pay for a vaccine is a scam. That's the key indicator. So your vaccine is going to be free and it's going to be offered to you by the NHS. Anybody requesting a payment is wrong. And that's a scam. So if you want to report that, you can report it to an organisation called Action Fraud. And you can, there's a phone number for them, there's an email address, that's all on their website. But if anything that asks you to pay for a vaccine, that's definitely a scam. I should add that I heard some worrying reports this morning that at one of our local GP surgeries, a patient had phoned the surgery because they had received a phone call which somebody claimed was from the surgery, telling them that the Batchford Hall vaccination site was full and therefore they couldn't book a vaccination anymore and that somebody was going to come to their house. That is also a scam. That is not happening. If you are in any doubt at all, hang up and then ring for your GP surgery yourself on the number that you have to query it. So I know it's a real danger at the moment, and I think it's outrageous that people are pushing these scams. That's the way to spot them. Anybody asking for payment, that's a scam.
And this is what's really sad, is it's kind of attacking people who are not as technically literate as some of us. So emails as well that ask for money. And we will put up on the description here for this discussion today, when we put it up on the website, we'll put Action Fraud's information there so that people can follow it and help family members or friends who may be affected. So we move on to Susie, and she has asked, please can Daisy intervene to stop developers from decimating London Colney's Sheepsfield along Watery Lane with housing? This will decimate the area entirely, she says. I have lived there for almost 50 years. It will destroy our heritage and the nature reserve itself. What can you do there, Daisy?
I think the site that Susie's referring to is, this is the proposal for the new Garden Village of 8,000 new homes, which is in the Hartsmere local council plan. I have to say, I'm genuinely appalled that Hartsmere Council doesn't seem to have consulted residents in London Coney or Coney Heath. I did recently write to Hartsmere Council to lend my support to the two parish councils, the one in London Coney and the other in Coney Heath, who have raised concerns about the housing and specifically about the fact that they hadn't been consulted. As I say, this is a local planning matter, and therefore it's dealt with at a council level, not at a parliamentary level. But I have written to Hartsmere Council asking for them, supporting the concerns of our local residents and asking them to properly consult with local residents as well.
And can local residents message Hartsmere Council as well? Would you recommend that to maybe voice their opinions on the issue?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the frustrating things is that normally residents can only write to their own local council, and the problem we have is that residents in London Coney and Coney Heath are in the St Albans District Council area, but the plans are just on the border and they're being run by Hartsmere Council. So what I would really like is for Hartsmere Council to be proactive about consulting residents that just over the border in St Albans, but I would certainly encourage everybody to either write to Hartsmere Council or to write to their own local councillors in St Albans District Council who can then write to Hartsmere as well and make representations council to council.
So again, people can get involved in the politics there and message their local council to be able to have their opinion on that issue. Mark has messaged in and said, will Daisy vote to end lockdown measures and allow the opening of our great local pubs? In many cases, some of them go back hundreds of years. He also said, please do not say when it is safe, as anyone can say that.
Sure, look, this is a tricky issue and it's never going to keep everybody happy. But I think one of my big frustrations over the last 11 months has been that as a country, we've had all of the pain and none of the gain. And what we've had is the government has been too slow to lock down, and then it's been too quick to reopen. And as a result, we've never got the case rates down low enough that we've been able to sort of fully recover as a country. So we've had all the economic pain, but none of the gain from keeping rates down. And that's been a massive, massive problem. So actually, I want the government to be really cautious in the way that it reopens things. We've got all these new variants and the, you know, potentially new ones coming along. We don't know. So we've got to be very cautious about how we reopen. It's got to be one stage at a time. We know that most of the reduction in cases has been as a result of the lockdown. We don't know whether there's really been any reduction as a result of the vaccination program yet, because it's too early to say. And so we do need to look at the evidence and follow the science and follow the medical advice at every single stage. And I know it is frustrating when politicians say, you know, when it's safe to do so. And I understand that, but that's frustrating. I think what we really need to see is the detail. So for example, you know, I have been back calls to say that, you know, schools I believe should be one of the first areas that should reopen. But what's been deeply frustrating to me is that for months I and teachers and parents and unions and all sorts of different groups have been asking the government to put various sort of specific measures in place to make schools safer, and the government hasn't done that. So actually what I want to see is a plan for reopening that has a lot of detail about how it can be done in a safe way. We need to see smaller bubbles of students. We need to see school transport that respects bubbles and doesn't cut across them, because up until, you know, up until Christmas, we had school transport that was cutting across the bubbling system in schools because it was taking kids to multiple different schools. And we need to see proper ventilation being rolled out to schools so that they're not having, kids aren't having to sit in classrooms being freezing cold. There's all sorts of steps that we need to be taking. So I will be looking very closely at the detail of the government's announcement. The Prime Minister is set to make a statement on Monday. And we will have to take it one step at a time. But of course, I completely sympathise with the thrust of what Mark is saying. We all want things to go back to some kind of new normal, whatever that looks like. We all want our local businesses, you know, pubs and retail and everything else to thrive and to be able to open again. We all want to be able to, you know, mill about and see our friends and give people hugs. We want to be able to do all of those things. But we don't want to, we really shouldn't do those things if it means that we're going to have another spike in cases and another lockdown. We've really got to get these numbers under control, because the threats of long COVID and the long lasting effects of that are very, very dangerous. And the risk of more new strains coming about as a result of COVID transmitting, being transmitted, are also very high. So we've got to be incredibly careful at every single stage.
Is the big threat to opening up again, it will be closed very soon after if they do it too soon? Is this the big worry? Because obviously Widmark saying when it is safe, but there are certain parameters that the government and yourself are going to look at and say this is safe enough. But if the process is rushed, surely that will undo it all again, won't it, Daisy?
Well, I think there are two questions. One is around the timing. So, you know, when, so that was a question of when different bits of the economy start to reopen. The other question is how they reopen. And we need to see the detail on both of those. So, you know, if you said, okay, it's all right for schools to fully reopen, because obviously they're still open at the moment, but if you said, okay, it's okay for schools to fully reopen, and all the kids went back in on day one, you know, of course you probably see rates starting to go up again. But if there is a plan to say, okay, well, let's allow rotas, let's get some kids in school some of the time, so that, you know, so that every kid can be in school some of the time, that would be a really good step forward. Let's have rotas, let's have smaller bubbles, let's have proper ventilation systems in schools, and let's have a testing system that is approved by public health directors. If those specific measures are in place, then it may be that actually we can reopen parts of the economy without rates going up again. But if we go either too quickly or without enough specific measures in place and the rates start to go up again, then we may well end up getting stuck for the fourth time in this horrible cycle where we have to go into lockdown again. And one of the very specific challenges we have right now is that even though cases are going down, hospitalizations are still really, really high. And that's because people have been going to hospital, and it's a good news story in some ways, because they've gone to hospital because they had COVID, but they've survived. But that means that because they've survived and they haven't died, they've survived, they're actually having to stay in hospital for longer. So even though the overall numbers of cases are coming down, our hospitals are still gonna be at, you know, really, really kind of stretched and at breaking point, probably until the end of March. And if we open up too quickly, there is a risk that we put too much pressure on the NHS again and that they become overwhelmed. And we've got to be really, really sensitive of that.
Carol has moved it on to a lighter topic here, and she's talking about the saints who are on Radio Verulam quite regularly. We do our live commentaries on them, but she's talked about how our Saints Football Club are having a great season with only one game lost and are looking at a possible promotion. That would be really exciting if they did. But she has asked, will you be coming to watch some of those matches when COVID regulations allow?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'd love to. I've already had an invitation and I can't wait to come and see a game. It'd be really, really fun.
So do you have like a footballing tradition? Would you get a pie? Would you get a hot bovril or would you join in any of that? I mean, one of the big questions, and I'm sure the sports fans, because I also do the sports show, would be interested to know, would you have a name on the back of your shirt and what number would you get?
Yeah, interesting. So I'll be honest, I've never been a big supporter of any particular sport, but when I go to any kind of game, I'm fiercely competitive, so I throw myself into it. So even though I sort of don't necessarily follow football, I do love going to games and getting into the swing of things. I've never thought about having a club shirt, so maybe you could ask your listeners for some suggestions.
Maybe we could put it to a vote. Which number should Daisy get on her shirt? I mean, do you not have like a lucky number? Because I always get 10, but maybe you can have a mull over for when COVID allows as well. I think you've got a bit of time before then. So sure. The final question, and I think this is one of the most important topics at the moment that James has discussed. And it's also with a tinge of sadness, because he's explained that I have friends and family who are skeptical about vaccines and are believing some of the conspiracies / disinformation you are challenging, Daisy. I'm the youngest in the family, so they don't often listen to me, but can you recommend a good source to combat their disinformation and make them listen?
Sure. I mean, that's a really, really good question. I guess the key difference here is there is a really big distinction between people who are just outright anti-vaxxers who don't want the vaccination and they're not going to have it at all. And then all those people who are, which is quite a small group, but there's quite a bigger group of people who are just hesitant, and they're hesitant for all sorts of reasons. So some people might be hesitant because they've maybe had a bad reaction to other vaccines in the past, or maybe because they don't know what's in the vaccine and they want to check. There's all sorts of reasons why people have a little bit of hesitancy about the vaccine, but there's a lot of really reliable information out there. So most of the information can be found on the NHS website, and I would really encourage people to go to the NHS website, because it is an authoritative place to go. There's been quite a lot of articles in Full Fact, which is a kind of fact-checking website that can answer some of these questions as well. If you're in any doubt, talk to your local GP. Your GP can answer your questions if you have any. And what I've been really, really pleased to see is that we've had lots of different community figures in St Albans, particularly from minority groups. We've had the local imam from the local mosque doing a video as well, talking about the importance of everybody getting their vaccine. Local councillors have been making little videos to say that they've been getting their vaccine as well and promoting that. And there are lots of videos around in different languages. For anybody who doesn't have English as their first language. So it's been really wonderful to see people stepping forward in St Albans and taking part in those videos and answering people's questions. But if people are hesitant or they've got questions, there is reliable information out there. If they can't find it, then, as I say every time I come on the show, drop me an email at daisy.cooper.mp@parliament.uk, and we can send you links to reliable sources of information that can answer your questions.
Building upon this, does it sadden you that sometimes now facts are becoming politicised? You see a lot of these discussions, vax and anti-vax, and I'm not suggesting that they're on different ends of the political spectrum, but sometimes a lot of the news source and information of this disinformation is becoming political. Is that something that worries you going forward? And I suppose as your role in the media culture secretary, the shadow position that you have, does that worry you that this is something that does need to be tackled head on going forward?
Yeah, so I think the spread of disinformation is incredibly worrying. And it's not sort of, it's not so much about facts getting politicized. It's about the fact that there are people who, there are political forces that want to deliberately destabilize our democracies. And they can, they're trying to do that in many ways by spreading disinformation about all sorts of issues. And COVID the COVID vaccinations have been subject to these attacks of disinformation. And I do find it extremely worrying. And so I think there is more work that needs to be done, both in terms of building public trust in authoritative sources of science and advice, and real proactive work, which is happening already, but by our local public health authorities to reach people who have, you know, genuine questions, and maybe it's a little bit hesitant. And it's really important not to mix those two things, because actually the misinformation that is being sort of spewed out is really dangerous. It's really dangerous. And in a global pandemic, it could actually result in the loss of life. And so there's a big difference between the disinformation, which is very worrying, and then the other issue, which is just the question of hesitancy, where people have legitimate questions and they should be able to, people should be able to feel like they can ask those questions without getting judged or questioned or being name called or anything like that. It's completely legitimate to want to know what is in a vaccine that you're about to put in your body. And there is lots of information out there and people can answer your questions. So if people are hesitant, they've got questions, please look at the NHS website or drop me an email or, you know, something like that. That's we can answer your questions. But the disinformation is very worrying and we do need to see action to tackle those sites that promote it.
Do you believe that the government, especially the Conservative Party itself, needs to do more to curtail the politicisation or discussion points about disinformation? Because you wrote a quote for a Guardian article this month, basically discussing about how the Conservatives were courting or discussing with groups that do share disinformation. Does something need to be done from there? Because obviously with their lead, leading the vaccination scheme, that kind of devalues it, doesn't it, if they're also discussing with groups that are peddling misinformation?
Well, the case that I commented on was an example of two or three specific Conservative MPs. So it wasn't the whole party, but two or three specific Conservative MPs who have been working with platforms that had already been identified as promoting misinformation. And therefore, where a site has already been identified as promoting misinformation and has been told to fix that, it's very worrying that elected members of parliament would then sort of continue to work with them. So that was the point I was trying to make. I think it is important that the government does more. I believe that there needs to be a proper regulatory system in place so that platforms, social media platforms, have a greater obligation to tackle this misinformation and to tackle it more quickly, and that it's easier for members of the public to question and report such sources of misinformation. And I think what they also need to do is look at the algorithms that exist. So for example, if somebody watches a bare knuckle fight video on Facebook, you might find yourself that within two or three clicks, the content that you're being recommended to look at is linked to misinformation. And actually, it is a responsibility on that platform to change its algorithm so that it isn't promoting misinformation and that it prioritizes it in the algorithm. There's a lot more that could be done by these sites, and I think we need a proper system of regulation in place to put the onus of responsibility on them to manage what they are, to manage the information that is being published on their website, on their platforms.
Well, I hope that James found all this information useful, and hopefully he can get some positive vibes from the discussions with his family there, because obviously, as we said there, Daisy, people can have their legitimate concerns, but the concern is if it is coming from misinformation, then maybe that needs to be challenged. But as always, thank you for your time today, Daisy. And for those of you who didn't have their question answered, Daisy will be returning next month. But for now, and for the next month, till we speak again, I wish you health and happiness, Daisy.
And to you. Thanks, Jason.